Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
What can Brown do for Democrats? Put them on the ropes.
We're not going to rush into anything. We're going to wait until the new senator arrives before we do anything more on health care.
Democrats in the Senate move into triage mode.
I would advise that we try to move quickly to coalesce around those elements of the package that people agree on.
But can this patient be saved? Or is it time for the last rites for health care legislation? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. Thursday, January 21st. I'm Miles O'Brien in our week for Celeste Headlee. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Miles. So the delicate coalescing, we're going to talk about that in just a moment. But let's get right to the top stories we are following. President Obama is blaming the Democrats' stunning loss of their filibuster-proof Senate majority on his failure to connect to the economic frustrations of the middle class in the United States. When it comes to passing the health care reform bill, he told ABC News last night,
"The Senate certainly shouldn't try to jam anything through until Scott Brown is seated. People in Massachusetts spoke. He's got to be part of that process."
But what do congressional Democrats think about what the president just said there? We're joined now by Representative Anthony Weiner from New York. Congressman, first of all, good morning. Thanks for being a part of the program.
Good morning.
Are you happy that suddenly the House takes center stage here?
Well, no, it's hard to be happy as someone who's a supporter of strong health care reforms and a supporter of President Obama. We've got a mess because we've got three groups, Republicans who won't want to do anything ever, independents who seem confused by the whole process, and people like me who feel that a lot of our values have been compromised in this process. So you said it right. It's kind of a mess right now.
Although wouldn't the Constitution, wouldn't the framers say, get together, guys, compromise?
Well, that's exactly right. But, you know, part of what needs to happen now is I think we need the president, and he acknowledged this yesterday, needs to strongly lead and lean into this problem, this notion of worshiping at the altar of 60 votes has complicated and confused our message.
Well, we're going to talk about that altar of 60 votes in the Senate with Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner. Stay with us. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
The Pentagon is ordering another 2,000 Marines to Haiti, which will push the number of U.S. troops in and around the island to 16,000 by the weekend. Speaking in the past half hour on The Takeaway, Michelle Montaz, a Haitian journalist and a former spokesperson for the U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, says a big priority for the U.N. is helping the huge number of wounded.
A lot of them are being evacuated to the Dominican Republic. The U.N. has created, with the help of the Dominicans, has created a protected corridor to go from Port-au-Prince to Jimani and to Santo Domingo to give people assistance.
John also spoke to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, about the military's main priorities in Haiti.
But our main effort, our main focus, main goal is to provide this relief and provide security for the relief effort.
More of that interview on thetakeaway.org. Authorities now say 2 million people have been left homeless by the earthquake.
In economic news, the number of newly laid off workers seeking jobless benefits unexpectedly rose last week as the job market recovers at a slow and uneven pace. Initial claims for unemployment insurance rose by 36,000 to 482,000, according to the Labor Department. Economists had expected a small drop. Moving to Wall Street, Goldman Sachs expected to announce 2009 bonuses today. They've set aside between $16 and $19 billion in compensation for last year. They've also announced their earnings for the final quarter. This comes as President Obama is expected to announce a plan later this morning that will give the government new powers to limit the size of the nation's largest banks. It may be a return to Glass-Steagall. Asian markets mixed. European indices up. Futures are down now. The Dow gets underway at 10,603. The S&P 1,138. And the NASDAQ opens in less than a half an hour at 2,291.
Coming up on the show, you've probably seen war coverage in print, on TV, and in photos. Heard it on the radio, too. But what about in comics? We'll talk with graphic novelist and journalist Joe Sacco about the violence in Gaza later this hour.
Coming up, the altar of the 60-vote rule in the Senate. Should it change? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. More about that in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. As I was pulling out of Washington, D.C. yesterday on Capitol Hill, there was all kinds of reaction to the election result on Tuesday night in Massachusetts, electing a Republican senator, Scott Brown, for the first time in 50 years. Listen to Senator John McCain on the Senate floor yesterday.
Last night, a shot was fired around this nation. A shot was fired saying, no more business as usual in Washington, D.C. Stop this unsavory sausage-making process called health care reform.
So, question there, Senator McCain raises it. What is business as usual in Washington, D.C.? And is this about health care reform or something broader, something bigger, something possibly even constitutional in nature?
Or sausage.
or what is the sausage, exactly? Sausage is tasty, not good to look at, right? Isn't that the word? That's Representative Anthony Weiner is still with us. He's on the phone from his home in Washington. Thanks for being with us, Representative.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And also, we are privileged to have Julian Zelizer, a congressional historian at Princeton University. He's the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Julian Zelizer, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
So, Professor Zelizer, Anthony Weiner said at the top of the hour that he's sick and tired or something, I think I'm characterizing it correctly, of worshiping at the altar of the 60-vote rule in the Senate. Does he have a point there, and when did this altar get built?
Well, I think it's one of the greatest sources of frustration. Now we expect 60 votes on almost every piece of legislation in the Senate. It's a product of the last two or three decades, really, as the filibuster gradually became a normalized tool of combat in American politics. It wasn't this way before the 1970s. And so now we have a supermajority Senate where that 60 is always required.
And now it's less than 60, and so the Senate is not going to be able to pass its own bill or pass a conference bill. What is the impact of the 60-vote rule on your business in the House of Representatives, Democratic Representative Anthony Weiner?
Well, I'll give your listeners some perspective on this. If we didn't have 60 votes, if we simply had majority rule, which we're all taught about in elementary school in this country, we'd probably have a public option. We'd probably have an expanded Medicare with a longer life expectancy for the program. We'd probably have the donut hole for prescription drugs that would be closed so seniors wouldn't be without coverage. And we'd probably have things like, you know, young people when they get out of college being covered under their parents' plan. You know, a lot of the things that are very popular that people in Massachusetts and around the country would probably say we really want passed would probably not only have been passed, but would have been passed with great fanfare. And the American people would have been, instead of disenfranchised and disenchanted, would have been very happy. So this 60-vote rule is really what is giving us the logjam that so many people are decrying, including John McCain in your last bite.
Now, you mentioned learn about majority rule in elementary school, and I did, and I think a lot of people do. Do we have a strange sort of culture of bipartisanship or talking about it in the United States? I mean, majority rules, party line votes, that's a sign of the function of the system. But we're taught to believe by people in the media and elsewhere that, in fact, that's a sign of dysfunction, that if you don't have bipartisanship, there's something wrong. Anthony Weiner?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, we all talk about the desire for bipartisanship, but what the American people really want is us to get stuff done. And frankly, the frustration that we have in our recent congressional history and political history is people decry bipartisanship and gridlock, the lack of bipartisanship and gridlock at the same time. What they really want is for us to get things done that they like. When you scrape away everything else, that's what they want. And frankly, the procedural machinations in the Senate have created this environment of inertia that I think really is what the American people want us to get past.
So, Julian Zelizer, is there some historical precedent or is the historical milestone that people like you are going to write about, you know, years from now, that this is the first time a president sort of bet an entire program on the 60-vote rule and got his head handed to him?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of presidents have bet on one big piece of legislation. But, you know, usually you hope that you come out of it with something. So we had compared him to Lyndon Johnson, who betted on really a 67-vote bill, which was civil rights. but he pushed and shoved and cajoled, and he got Republicans to come over to his side, but not through nice politics, through hardball politics. And he got the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, and his story turned out much differently, at least on domestic policy. The problem here is, I think, he hoped for bipartisanship with a party that wasn't going to give a single vote, and I don't think he was willing to use the hammer, so to speak, to get some of those votes one way or another. So I do think it's a kind of stark contrast so far with Lyndon Johnson, that Civil Rights Bill, and the rest of the Great Society.
Great context there. So is this an argument for harder ball politics on the part of the president, or is it an argument for changing the rule? That rule eventually went from 67 to 60, right?
It does, but not till 1975. And so he gets it with the existing structure. Look, one path is filibuster reform, but that's going to be extraordinarily difficult to achieve. So lowering the number of senators required from 60 to even lower, 55, 50. The other is using things like reconciliation, the budget process that allows you to avoid a filibuster. And finally, the other is to use presidential power to do what, you know, Speaker Pelosi does in the House and other speakers have done, to really lean on all members of the Democratic Party and force their hand to vote for this bill and do a little right. bit of that with Republicans.
And that's what whips do in the House of Representatives. Here's the Republican whip, Eric Cantor, giving his reaction to the Massachusetts result yesterday in Washington.
I look back a few months ago when I met with Majority Leader Hoyer, and I would guess this morning that perhaps he's thinking maybe he should have paid a bit more attention, because in that meeting I put forth our Republican plan to effect health care reform to bring down costs. There is a way for us to work together.
Democratic Representative Anthony Weiner of New York, is there a way for you to work together with Eric Cantor and the Republicans in the House?
Eric Cantor and his party has made it very clear that they are not going to participate in anything that will give President Obama any success. They've been the most partisan of hacks in this process. That's not a procedural problem. That's a strategic problem that the Republicans have made the determination. They don't want the president to have any success, and so that's the posture they've taken. That's fine, but I think the president needs to lean into this thing, travel around the country, talk about the popular elements of this plan, and lead by the way we only get big bills in this country is by muscular presidential leadership.
Muscular presidential leadership. Well, we will watch for that. Representative Anthony Weiner, Democrat of New York, thanks so much for that discussion, along with Jillian Zelizer, congressional historian at Princeton University, author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security. Thanks to both of you. At 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on the headlines we're following. Miles?
The president says the Senate should not try to push health reform through until Massachusetts Senator-elect Scott Brown takes up his seat in Washington. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressman Bart Stupak says there's no support in the House for the health care bill that was approved by the Senate.
If you ran that Senate bill right now on the House floor, I'll bet you would not get 100 votes for it.
Democrats admit they may have to accept a less ambitious health overhaul.
Some new economic figures out in the past hour. The Labor Department says new claims for unemployment insurance rose by 36,000 to 482,000 last week. Economists had expected a small drop, and it's moving the markets. Futures are down about 15 minutes before Wall Street opens. Moving to Haiti, U.S. hospital ship Comfort is treating the severely wounded. Captain Andrew Johnson says the ship expects to be stationed in Haiti for some time to come.
We want to make sure that infrastructure has been built back up in the country and they can handle. We don't want to put a Band-Aid on the problem and then take off.
Here at home, one story. The weather deluge continues in Southern California. Another Pacific storm taking aim. Forecasters say it could bring up to 3 inches of rain and 20 inches of snow in some places. What's your online password? According to our partner, the New York Times, the most popular password is 123456. Guys, come on. Amazingly enough, the second most popular password, 12345.
12345.
12345.
Yes.
That's amazing. I've got the same combination on my luggage.
You spaceballs. Password was even in the top 20. Internet analysts say, don't make it so easy for hackers. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time to take out some cash, so to speak. And for those who wonder where the regulators and the regulations were when the economy tanked, there's a new plan in the works. The president will unveil it at 11:45 a.m. Eastern Time. The idea is to give the government more control over the banks. That's the idea, anyhow. Louise Story is back, quick as the Acela, finance reporter for the New York Times. Good to have you with us again, Louise. Tell us about this proposal. What do we know about it?
So we only know a few details, Miles, but we know it's focused on the size of the banks and the amount of risk they take. And, of course, this is the biggest criticism from the crisis, that these banks not only got so big that we had to save them because they were too big, but also that they were taking too many risks. They were trading for their own books. They were investing in mortgages, when what they're supposed to be doing is taking your money, holding it safely as deposits, and doing the instrumental kind of pipeline banking of the country.
Oh, what a quaint notion you have there.
What a quaint notion. But, you know, that's what, in the Depression, when we had, you know, a similar crisis, there were these laws created known as Glass-Steagall that split up the banking, the traditional pipeline banking of this country, from the trading. And that was all repealed in the late 90s so that banks could do both. And that's one of the things that some people think got us into this crisis. So today, with this announcement, we'll all be listening for how much will this take us back to a separation between regular banking and trading. You know, and
well, maybe we should listen to the lessons of history here. Who's been pushing this?
Well, the interesting thing is that Paul Volcker, you know, who is a former chairman of the Fed, has been pushing and pushing publicly since the fall that you should really rein in the prop trading at these banks. It's the prop trading that leads to
prop trading, meaning
proprietary trading, okay. Trading for your own book. And that's what leads to a lot of the big bonuses and payday on Wall Street that you're seeing now. Excuse me. And so it's very interesting. He's been pushing for it. Obama hasn't been listening. I think this could be a major shift in the Obama administration. Remember, they put out a full...
Well, it's a shift in... I mean, Larry Summers was part of the crew that deregulated
that's
everything.
That's right. Larry Summers, a top yeah. economic advisor, deregulated
yeah.
this in the Clinton years. And I would have loved to have been on this conversation with Obama and Volcker recently, where Obama says to Volcker, I know you've been pushing for this all year. I know you've been pushing. I didn't do it last summer when I proposed financial reform, but okay, Volcker, you're right. Let's do it. Let's rein in these
banks. Elizabeth Warren has specifically endorsed that proposal
That's
on
right.
this program. That's true.
Right.
The oversight person on the TARP. All right, thanks, Louise. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our takeaway sports contributor, is watching the football this weekend. And, you know, everyone loves, all of a sudden, the New York Jets.
We thought we had a great chance, you know, to make it to the playoffs, but... Atlanta found a way to win.
That's Coach Rex Ryan, who thinks the Jets are the team to beat. He's actually saying the goal of the Jets is one thing.
Collectively, our team has one goal, one focus, and that's to try to win the Super Bowl.
So Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports contributor, you've got Rex Ryan with a sad face there in that first cut, and Rex Ryan with a very happy face, and some would say a kind of delusional face looking forward to the Super Bowl.
That's funny, a delusional face. The entire playoff run that the Jets have made could seem potentially delusional and dreamy, and that's exactly what the Jets need to do. That's one of the things that they need to beat the Colts.
Yeah.
They need to be a little bit in the clouds. Now, I'll tell you, they need to do three or four things that will guarantee them a win. Number one, they need to score over 20 points. If they don't score over 20 points, the Indianapolis Colts will surely score over 20 points, and they'll stop them quickly. The other thing is that the Jets quarterback Mark Sanchez has thrown interceptions this year at critical moments. They need to stop that. That cannot happen. He threw one interception last game, but in the past 4 or 5 weeks, he's been very excellent, actually, in that arena. And part of it is because they don't make him throw in very tense situations. They run the ball so much. So there's two other things. The Indianapolis defense is a porous run defense. Their main people are pass rushers, and they come from the outside, like Dwight Freeney, who I told you earlier in the season
yes,
was a
did.
Key to the Colts you winning, getting this far. Now, they're not great on the run defense, and that's where the Jets have a strength. Their offensive line is going to push them off the ground, and that will be a strong—Sean Green is going to be excellent for them. The other piece is—
Are you saying the Jets are favored? That's not what they say in Las Vegas.
In football terms, in football language, the Jets have a really—the matchups are really excellent. And the other matchup that's good is that the Colts' wide receiver core is not as good as the Chargers, who the Jets beat last week.
All right.
They're a bunch of rookies, and the Jets have amazing cornerbacks and defensive backs. They have a strength— strength in their defense and in their running game, and they can beat the Colts this weekend.
All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
You know, it's a rematch of Super Bowl III.
That is true.
Joe Namath should be out there doing the coin toss.
That's interesting. Good call. Yeah. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, talking about Jets versus Colts this weekend, also the Vikings versus the Saints in the other big game. Our last takeout comes from our listeners, right?
Yes.
This is Sam calling from Philadelphia. I'm very frustrated with the way things are happening. And with the health care bill, it looks like the politicians are more interested in making a name for themselves than they are in what's good for the country.
We've been hearing what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE and by email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Was it really a referendum on health care, on politics in Washington, maybe?
I'm an independent, and I'm calling to say that I think the reaction that we're seeing around the country against Democrats has to do in large part with the fact that health care is being treated far too politically. It's just too important to be rammed through without agreement on both sides.
Like most people around the world, I am just shocked that Americans are so opposed to health care reform. I think what Americans have is called the Stockholm Syndrome. In this case, the American people are the hostages, and the hostage takers are the large pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies.
Do you feel like a hostage? What's the message from Massachusetts? Lewis emailed us. They should keep the 60-vote rule in the Senate, he writes us, but the filibuster rule should go back to speaking for 24 hours. Congress makes everything too easy for themselves. Today we're asking you about the loss of the Democrats' filibuster-proof majority. Does having less than 60 votes mean that Congress can't pass health care? Should the rule change? You know how to reach us. 8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we'll give you an idea of how hard it is to treat the injured and infirmed in Haiti. That's in a few minutes. Here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour right now. Goldman Sachs announced this morning it's rewarding its employees with $16 billion in bonuses for 2009. That's up 47% from the previous year, but still lower than many had expected. And I had to go into journalism. The average out to about $600,000 per employee.
You know, I'm looking at their earnings. They earned a profit. The profit was a record, $13.4 billion last year. That's 2009. That's a record profit.
No justice. In about 2 hours, President Obama is expected to announce a plan that will give the government new powers to limit the size of the nation's largest banks, as well as their ability to engage in high-risk trades.
But last night, President Obama told ABC News about the lessons he learned this week from Massachusetts.
Here's my assessment of not just the vote in Massachusetts, but the mood around the country. You know, the same thing that swept Scott Brown into office swept me into office. People are angry and they're frustrated.
The president is ordering more U.S. troops to Haiti in another story. Right now, 11,000 soldiers are in and around Haiti with another 2,000 Marines headed to the earthquake zone soon. In the bay surrounding Port-au-Prince, USNS Comfort, that hospital ship, is treating some of the worst-off patients. This naval surgeon on board is impressed with how long many badly injured Haitians have been able to survive.
The fact that they've made it, you know, 7 days out, 8 days out with these injuries and they're still here just speaks, you know, worlds towards how resilient, you know, they are.
Yesterday at the Pentagon, I asked Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen about the military's role in Haiti.
We've worked with the Haitian leadership from the beginning. I mean, we are there in support of the Haitian leadership, overall, the UN in terms of the relief efforts, and in particular the UN security forces supporting them from a security standpoint. But our main effort, our main focus, main goal is to provide this relief and provide security for the relief effort.
In another move to help Haiti recover, some banks are reportedly going to reopen this weekend. In economic news, the number of newly laid off workers seeking jobless benefits unexpectedly rose last week. It's moving the market, but it's bouncing around. Wall Street is opening just now. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 6 at this point. The S&P and the NASDAQ are all open and up fractionally. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
The good ship Comfort has steamed into a sea of misery in Haiti. The huge floating hospital has 1,000 beds, a big number to be sure, but not compared to the need in Haiti. The worry this morning in that island nation, besides the prospect of more aftershocks, is will injured people who could otherwise survive die for lack of basic medical care? Our partner, the BBC, is there, witness to trauma care in frighteningly primitive conditions.
People are lying on wooden pallets, usually used for stacking goods up instead of beds. They've also run out of beds here. There are patients with very severe trauma injuries to the head, broken hands, broken legs. They are being treated by the doctors here, but the operating table is literally a wooden table with some clean paper, surgical paper put over it and stuck down with sellotape.
With us now is Dr. Arthur Fournier. He is the Associate Dean for Community Health Affairs at the University of Miami Leonard Miller School of Medicine. He just returned from Haiti. Dr. Fournier, welcome to the program. What from your visit in Haiti, what is the current status, as best we can tell, of medical care there?
Well, the current status is chaotic, but it's much less chaotic than it was a week ago. We ourselves, the Miller School of Medicine, have been engaged in Haiti for 15 years, and I think the connections we've made at all levels of society have allowed us to perhaps be a little less chaotic and a little bit more organized than perhaps other people of goodwill who haven't been engaged in Haiti. Today we are opening a full-fledged field hospital and we'll be evacuating our patients from the UN compound triage hospital where we first started the day after the earthquake.
What are the pressing needs right now? Early on, of course, supplies were a big problem. Has that problem been solved?
Been pretty much solved for us, but not for everyone. We have a close bond between people of goodwill at all levels of society in Miami and our Haitian American community, and a deep love for Haiti. So our outpouring of equipment and supplies, and the Miller School of Medicine's commitment to this relief effort has been extraordinary. And we were fortunate enough to have several families in Miami donate their private aircraft, and we've been sending three flights a day on the average since the day after the quake. And so we have good supplies of antibiotics, surgical supplies. We've been carrying on amputations. We're treating the infections that we see so commonly with this. We're resuscitating people from shock. And we're in pretty good shape. We are fortunate enough that the government gave us a plot of land right next to the airport to set up our field tents. And so our particular case, we're pretty good. I can't really speak for others.
Doctor,
we're doing okay.
Doctor, react to this. We've been hearing these voices all morning. Let me just give you some quotes. Here's an aid worker saying, "I'm trying to make a decision whether we keep this patient alive or not. Some doctors here say we have to let him go, but I don't want to give up on him." And another aid worker who we heard this morning, "It's harder when they come in conscious, begging you to save them, and there's nothing we can do." How do you respond to situations like that?
I think we just have to do the best we can under the circumstances we find ourselves in. In the very beginning, we were doing operations on kitchen tables, outdoors, because there was no light in the tent. Things have gradually improved, and just with every improvement, you try and save more lives and do more. We resuscitated a little girl, 6 weeks old, who was on death's doorstep with basically an IV and some fluids and some D50, and we were fortunate enough to have a plane on the runway ready to go back to Miami, so we evacuated her to Jackson Memorial Hospital here in Miami, and she's in perfect shape today.
Wow.
So you just do the best you can with the conditions on the ground.
Do what you can. Tell us about how things are going to evolve medically. We go from trauma into other concerns, disease, dysentery, cholera, that kind of thing.
We have knowledge on this. This crisis will evolve from trauma, fractures, crush injuries. We will see kidney failure as a result of many of the crush injuries. I don't need to go into the mechanism of that, but it's predictable. Then we're going to see a wave of infectious diseases. One that people haven't really talked a lot about, but we're going to see soon, is tetanus, which is an easy disease to prevent, but a horrible disease to treat. And then we're going to see diarrhea, dysentery, and pneumonia are predictable. We may see outbreaks of hepatitis and other foodborne diseases.
What's being done to stem that spread of disease?
Well, again, we're being proactive. We're flying in tetanus immune globulin today. We've got penicillin to treat tetanus. We've got surgeons to debride the wounds. We've got oral rehydration therapy, which you need to treat the diarrhea. I think people just have to think out of the box. For those of people of goodwill who've not worked in global health settings before, they need to consult with people who have.
Dr. Fournier?
The biggest missing link right now is that there's nobody really organizing all the various people of goodwill and giving them a specific assignment.
Dr. Arthur M. Fournier of the University of Miami Leonard Miller School of Medicine, thanks for your time. Coming up, reporting on a war-torn area might be hard enough as it is, but what if you did it with a sketch pad? We'll talk to Joe Sacco, author of the new graphic novel, Footnotes in Gaza. That's later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And as you just heard there, a doctor sort of assessing the losses in Haiti in medical terms. We've also been talking about the raw numbers of those dead, 50,000, perhaps 200,000. Now we're going to focus on the deaths of three individuals whose loss has been an extraordinary setback for the women's movement in Haiti. Miriam Merlet, Magalie Marceline, and Anne-Marie Coriolan were founders of three of Haiti's most important advocacy organizations working on behalf of women and girls. They died in last week's earthquake. And a friend and colleague of these three victims joins us now, Carol Charles, a sociology professor at Brooke College here in New York. Carol, tell us about the loss of these three individuals who you knew very well, and tell us about the work they did in Haiti.
I don't think we can wait. We can assess the impact of these women on people's life, and particularly on women and girls. My relationship with three of them, particularly with Miriam, date back to almost 40 years. And when we start working within the diaspora, particularly in Canada, organizing women, and we prepared Nairobi 85 together. She was in my house she spent the night in my house on her way to Montreal.
And her name was Miriam Merlet.
Uh-huh. And on December 21st, in fact, just an anecdote, I'm still drinking the coffee that she bought me from Haiti.
Oh.
And so my relationship with her in particular, and with these other women, Magalie
Marceline, right?
Right, Magalie Marceline and Marie Coriolan was very complex, both personally, intertwining my personal relationship, my militancy, and my political view about change in Haiti. I mean, we share those things, and sisterhood, in addition. So as I said to you know, in a note, it's really a large part of my life that is gone.
Wow. And these women, their career, their mission was to really open Haiti politically by empowering women and children.
Exactly. And it was one of the key things that they were always promoting is that we have to do politics differently. And part of doing politics differently, that was their slogan, was to bring women at the center of the decision-making and make women real citizens. Miriam organized a whole Caribbean in 2007, I think, a whole conference on citizenship in the region, one of the first ones in the region, and centering on women and access to citizenship, and really getting moving away from a type of citizenship that was second-class citizenship.
Well, three women with a very, very large legacy there. Magalie Marceline, Anne-Marie Coriolan, and Miriam Merlet, getting women more into the center of the political rebuilding of Haiti. That would certainly be their dream, but they were lost in the earthquake last week. Remembering them, Carol Charles, sociology professor at Baruch College in New York. She lost three of her close friends in the Haitian earthquake. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee. Coming up, a journey to Gaza. Traveling Gaza without a map, but with a sketch pad. Joe Sacco, graphic novelist, joins us. He has a new book out, Footnotes in Gaza. We're going to talk about it in a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes, or coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. The new senator-elect from Massachusetts, Scott Brown, is touching base with his new colleagues today. He'll meet with Senator John McCain and his new partner, Massachusetts senior senator John Kerry. And a former Democratic presidential candidate and Senator John Edwards has finally admitted he is the father of a child born to a woman he hired before his second White House bid. He said about the child, "It was wrong of me to ever deny she was my daughter." Little education there for John Edwards. Moving to Haiti.
Interesting if he would be President Edwards today. Wouldn't that be an interesting story?
Well, you know, actually in that book, Game Change, it's all about just what was going on behind the Edwards campaign. It's extraordinary. Moving to Haiti, the government says there are at least 75,000 people buried in mass graves following last week's earthquake. But some of the wounded are getting the medical help that they need. Earlier, we spoke to former spokeswoman at the UN, Michelle Montaz, who is herself Haitian and who's now in Haiti. She says there are still remarkable stories of survival.
We have lost almost all hopes to get more people alive. However, you know, there were a small number that got out of the rubble yesterday.
The UN's Michelle Montaz in Haiti. We spoke with her earlier. She's a former Haitian journalist. In Asia, China's economy has beaten expectations. I know you're shocked by that.
I'm just taking it back.
8.7% growth last year, despite the global recession. Economists expect it to overtake Japan as the world's second largest economy. And I know you're upset about that.
I'm still taken aback by Edwards. Right, exactly. I apologize. Here, Goldman Sachs rewarded its employees. This is another one that upsets me, too. I'm really all upset this morning. Goldman Sachs giving employees $16.2 billion in salary bonuses for 2009. Up 47% from the previous year. The figure may sound high, but it was lower than many had expected.
They still had record earnings, though.
Yeah, they did.
$13 billion.
And speaking of making lots of money, Conan O'Brien, not any relation of mine.
Not a banker either.
Walks away from the NBC Tonight Show with a severance package reported at about $30 million. The deal moves Jay Leno back to the program he hosted for 17 years. Under Leno, The Tonight Show was the ratings champ in the late night slot. His brief experiment in primetime, that was a dud. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
So when I was a foreign correspondent based in Jerusalem, I used to spend a lot of time in a place that spends a lot of time in the headlines around the world, Gaza. That territory, a little strip of land sometimes called the Gaza Strip. If you work in Gaza, if you go to Gaza, you descend into a place like no other. One of the densest places in the world, certainly one of the least politically stable places in the world, and an archive, in a sense, of history of the Palestinians and of the uneasy relationship that Israel has with its neighbors. If you can't go to Gaza yourself, you can appreciate and experience some of this descent by reading a new book called Footnotes in Gaza. It's Joe Sacco's new book. It's a graphic novel. It's based on two moments in Palestinian history that we're going to talk about in a moment, but visually, it is that descent into Gaza. The characters you meet are eerily like the real people that I spent time with back in the 80s. Joe Sacco, author of Footnotes in Gaza, is here in the studio with me. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Good to be here.
You know, it is amazing how much of a descent into the real Gaza that I remember this book is. But let's begin by talking about the historical underpinnings of this story that you tell in Footnotes in Gaza.
Okay. Palestinian refugees came to Gaza, and they started going back. There was a guerrilla war with Israel. And at some point in 1956, Israel, Britain, and France attacked Egypt. And Israel conquered the Gaza Strip at that, which was controlled by the Egyptians, and went into a couple of towns. And the UN, according to the UN, there were large numbers of civilian casualties.
And the story of this book is a character who looks remarkably like you, although not flatteringly so, going around and trying to find the truth of the matter. Is this journalism? And I guess you don't need to carry a microphone if you're a cartoonist in Gaza, right?
I think it is journalism, and I did carry a microphone.
Really?
I mean, I did interview people and taped conversations and all that sort of thing.
And did they know you were a cartoonist, or did they think you were just a journalist?
Well, I introduced myself as someone who was going to do their story in comics, and I showed my previous work about the Palestinians to them.
And your book, Palestine, which won awards, and your book about Garajda, a particularly brutal event in the Bosnian conflict, right?
Right. I showed them the book Palestine, and they would open it up and sort of see what I was trying to do. They could see themselves in a way in the drawings.
And your drawings are realistic. But I think the journey that you're on here reminds me a little bit, and there may be some listeners that go crazy when I say this, but of the work of Art Spiegelman, whose sort of Holocaust work, very stylized, is another attempt to use cartoons to get into a place that maybe feels more true, more raw than the journalism that we see.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'm kind of a comrade of Art Spiegelman. That's how I think of myself. We're friends. I think there's a lot you can do with the drawings that you can't do with regular sorts of journalism. I think you can really take a person to a place and to a time. Just like he does, I can take someone back into time also.
And, you know, looking at some of the pictures in here and seeing you against the wall drinking tea and eating chicken and rice and smoking cigarettes endlessly, the smells, the whole experience comes back completely. Are you striving for realism, or do you want people to get a larger point here?
Well, I am striving for realism. I do want people to get a sense of what it feels like there. I want people to feel the taste in the mouth that I had when I was there and sort of feel the dust swirling around their feet in the same way.
But you don't necessarily want them to have much sympathy for the Israelis here. I mean, Gaza is a place that doesn't have many points of view, it seems. There's a lot of factions within Gaza, but as far as the Israelis are concerned, this is one side of a story.
It is one side of a story. I'm telling mostly from the Palestinian point of view, though not entirely. But I don't sugarcoat Palestinians either. I mean, I'm trying to show Palestinians honestly.
Did you enjoy being in Gaza?
I love being in Gaza.
Really?
I like the place. I like the people. I know I can say that out of a sense that there's a luxury that I can get out. But the people are very hospitable. And it's always sort of a privilege to be invited into their homes and hear their stories.
And, you know, it seems to me, and I'm familiar with your work, that Gaza is kind of a place that goes with your personality, a sort of a sitting on the fringes kind of guy, maybe soft-spoken, doesn't render his opinions. And when he does, maybe they're a little dark. Did you find anything about Gaza, aside from the story, that was particularly compelling to you?
Aside from the story, I think it's just the way people treated me, mm-hmm. the hospitality. Talking about other things also, the black humor.
You know, people talk, we talk on this program a lot, and I'm sure you hear this a lot, that, you know, the media is changing. Forms of journalism are changing. Styles of journalism are changing. We talk a lot about Twitter. Twitter was the first indication of what happened in Haiti, for instance. There's right. a lot of discussion of Twitter in the Iranian Revolution, a place where I can see you easily going to maybe do your next book. But should we also include these forms as well? Many fewer people are writing comics about Gaza than are Twittering, but nevertheless.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, I think the form is here to stay, and I think other people are going to try using the form to do journalism.
And does it matter whether you render your images realistically or, as Spiegelman does, as animal characters?
Well, the interesting thing about doing it in cartoon forms is there are a lot of ways to do it. I mean, Spiegelman anthropomorphized figures, and I'm drawing realistically, but I think both ways work.
Although I think you don't draw yourself realistically. You are the ugliest character in your own books.
And in reality, I'm a good-looking guy.
And you can go to our website and actually determine if that is indeed the case. Joe Sacco, author of Footnotes in Gaza, it is a decent a descent into a place like no other on Earth, and you can experience it by reading the book. Joe Sacco, thanks so much for being with us. If you want to see what the comic book war reporting looks like, we have a slideshow of pages from Footnotes in Gaza. That's at our website, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our podcast to catch up on anything you've missed or want to re-listen to. One of the things you'll definitely want to check out is our interview with Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen. You can also watch more at thetakeaway.org, where you can see Admiral Mullen talk about who helps him with his own Twitter feeds. Well, this morning we're talking with you about the Democrats' loss in Massachusetts. We've been hearing for months that you need those 60 votes in the Senate to get health care reform passed. What do you think about not reaching that magic number? Do you have any advice for how the Dems can get their mojo back?
Charlie in Harrington Park, I think we should make the Democratic leadership eat more red meat and watch the entire Die Hard series back to back before they begin any new policy decisions. We're gonna die, 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 die.
your suggestions and scenarios at 877-8MYTAKE or thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Miles O'Brien, and this is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.